we talk about vulnerable populations, I'm going to focus specifically on the homeless and on migrant farm workers and on Indian Health Service. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on each to kind of paint a picture, but not going to go really in depth on each of them. But at the first half, I'd like to talk a little bit about just what makes a population vulnerable, because there are many vulnerable populations outside of these categories. These categories aren't necessarily the only vulnerable populations in our society. Could you roll the tape, please? So what I'd like to do to start today is to talk a little bit about what makes a population vulnerable. And because we have fewer people, and I find this room to be more easy for discussion, I'd like to just first ask you all that. What makes a population vulnerable? And you can look at it in a couple ways, but at any point we could be all vulnerable. But when we talk about a vulnerable population like this, what is it about them?
Lack of education.
Okay.
Poverty.
Good.
Fall through the cracks.
What cracks?
They're probably right near where they need to be, but then they get kind of glossed over and they don't get the services that they need. So there's between where they are and where the services, mm-hmm. and they just go in there and go on their own way.
What do you think causes them to not get the services they need, that causes them to fall through the cracks?
Knowledge of what's mm-hmm. going on, how hard they want to pursue it. For some people, they don't want to go any further because their life is so overwhelmed at this point mm-hmm. that they can't go and seek mm-hmm. help. And probably language would be another barrier.
Good. So there's cultural barriers. Yeah.
Yeah. Along those lines, could it also be that the people providing the services aren't fully aware of what services are needed by certain groups?
Yep, absolutely. You know, that's come up a couple times. Basically, just
if you don't have any connection with Native Americans, you might not know about their special
yep.
needs.
And yep, needs. And they might not know what's available to them as well.
Mm-hmm. I think society forces advertising. It's not encouraged. A healthy lifestyle is not encouraged.
Especially to certain populations, maybe as well, they feel rather alienated. Think of advertising and think of who are in those ads often. They're not appealing to necessarily everyone in society. Mm-hmm. Well, good. Basically, a very simple definition about vulnerability, which I think is interesting because it's got two sides to it, is that to be vulnerable to others is to be in the position of being hurt or ignored, or as well as being helped by others. So when we talk about vulnerable, it always doesn't have to have the negative connotations, but often we are in a position to help people, so we say that they are a population that can benefit from services or benefit from our care. So if you look at both, that means any given time we could all be in a vulnerable situation. We can be helped or hurt. So no one's sort of invincible, okay? There are two sort of ethical or ideological norms that, when we talk about vulnerable populations, that creep in to people's mentality as to who's vulnerable or who's at a disadvantage. One of them is sort of our American individualism. We like to think of things as an individual perspective. And in fact, in my Dad's and I healthcare series this last 2 weeks, we've even talked a little bit about the fact that everyone has a personal responsibility to care for their health. That we have to try to do the best we can to eat right and to exercise. And it's not always someone else's responsibility. But an individual's perspective, looking at vulnerable populations, attributes their poor physical and mental and social health to an individual behavior that basically results from their free choice. Okay? So a lot of people think that this is true, but there is obviously another side. They say, well, a lot of people don't choose to be born into the situation they're in, or to be of a certain race or gender, and these things automatically set them up potentially for some failure. So the flip side, or other sort of ideological norm, is to look at vulnerable populations from a community perspective, which fits in nicely with our theme this week, or I guess this summer. And the community perspective says that vulnerable populations, poor health is attributed as a function of one's community's failures to invest and assume responsibility for the well-being of all of its members. Okay, so putting the onus of responsibility back on our shoulders to say, I may be fortunate, but from a community perspective, there are others in the that no matter how much they try to take care of their own, they still are vulnerable and they still deserve our help. Okay. For government purposes, vulnerable populations, which is why I think it's important to talk about these groups, government purposes pretty much identify people categorically. They do this so that they can put them into multiple programs or devise programs. But each of these programs has a very different funding stream, usually has very different eligibility requirements, and so there's not coordination. Maybe, as we'll see, the Indian Health Service, you have to be Indian as a percentage of your background to use that. But if you are living as a someone in that community, in a rural community, you are not allowed to use the Indian Health Service. You might be homeless. Well, then there are homeless programs with certain funding streams and certain eligibility, but they don't necessarily coordinate or use each other. So for the government, on one hand, they're doing a good job at trying to create programs and do things for these categories of people. On the other hand, by categorizing everybody by these certain characteristics, they're not necessarily viewing everyone as a community member with the availability and accessibility to each of these services, okay? Looking at it, without getting sort of too theoretical about vulnerable populations, there's three different categories that are used or factors that predict an individual's risk of poor health. And they're usually, or they're all related to the distribution or availability of resources, okay? So to just walk through these a little bit, in fact, I'm gonna put them on the board because they all sound slightly similar. One is social status. Again, these are just how people create these categories. Another is social capital. And the last is human capital. So you see they do kind of use each other's terms, unfortunately, so they're kind of confusing. But social status is associated very much with demographics, okay? How you're perceived in society. So, and your position, therefore, because of your demographics. Functions such as your age, your sex, your race, and the various opportunities and rewards that come with that perceived status in society. And although we like to say it's a democratic, you know, equity-based system, a lot of those demographic factors slot you into positions in society that either make you able or not able to have a lot of sort of social status, okay? Social capital, on the other hand, is the quantity and quality of interpersonal ties between people. So your family structure, whether you have a close family that's either extended or even just a small nuclear family, whether you don't have a family structure at all, whether you have intimate relationships, friends, social groups, church, community, all of these things sort of increase your social capital and put you at an advantage over people who don't have those interpersonal ties and who are sort of left to fend on their own, all right? And the third, which is human capital, is this is a way to sort of measure the community's investments in things like schools, educational systems, environmental programs, you know, reduction of pollution or getting power lines out from kids' playgrounds and all of these kind of things that a community can do to increase the human capital or in essence invest in the people and housing, anything like that that are gonna actually affect the skills and capabilities of everybody in the community. So when you look at those three things, you can start to see where various vulnerable populations are gonna start to crop up. And basically, I want to start with the homeless. But before I move on to a particular population, is there any question or any discussion you want to have at all about what makes a group vulnerable?
I guess we said something about this last night in our whole series, and on Thursday of this week I'm going to be talking about it, and we have it sort of out of sequence. Understand that I'm going to be talking about the ethics of healthcare. And we would really have preferred, because some of the things that Leah is saying, the ethics of healthcare suggests that in the name of justice, in the name of beneficial help to people, those sorts of things is why we can even consider these in the United States. And that probably, that topic may have been better preceding the one that's being presented tonight, but for reasons that we've also shared with a number of you, the sequence has fallen as it is. So just know that on Thursday night, I am going to be talking about the ethics, and it includes public health. And public health is, in fact, to many people's way of thinking, social justice. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're talking about, but it happens to be falling Thursday night.
Well, the interesting thing, too, when you look at ethics is sort of we have an, if you consider yourself ethical or as a community, an ethical obligation to increase each one of those. I mean, that's a good way or a basis of decision making is how do we increase the social status, the social capital, and the human capital of all of these people, which can be a whole discussion in and of itself. I'm not sure what you're going to be doing.
I don't tell her. Just because she's my daughter, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Would you classify those three as being atypical to the U.S. of A. or universal problem?
This is a way of categorizing where someone might, factors that might affect who has resources and who doesn't and why. And depending on your age, you know, generally younger people might not have as much money as older people, or ethnic minorities might be at a disadvantage. Some of that social status, depending on the opportunities you had for education. So it's purely a way of trying to understand why some are haves and why some are have-nots, rather than just saying because. I think that every country, every human being has various measures of this. Each one of us have certain knocks and certain advantages in each one of those categories. But all people could be evaluated in those three terms, yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking primarily about healthcare, is that correct?
Yeah. Primarily about healthcare. This session does have a tendency to look at more or look a little bit at the public health model, so sort of a community perspective, but it's very much based in the access and improvement of health, right?
Are you including housing in your healthcare discussion?
Well, actually, you're right on track, and you've led me perfectly, because when we talk about the homeless, guess what their number one problem is? You know, I'll actually ask a question. I'll ask it right now. Before we talk about the various populations, I guess one of the things when we talk about ethics and we talk about the healthcare system, is it appropriate or feasible of a healthcare system to try to achieve this social parity, or in essence the equality of human beings in vulnerable populations? Is it that system's responsibility to do these things, to bring the level up and to equal the playing field, or is it someone else's responsibility?
When you say whose responsibility, they, who are you saying they?
The healthcare system is often asked and turned to say, this isn't fair. The homeless are sick, they're mentally, have a higher mental illness. And again, we'll talk about some of this, but people then turn to the healthcare system to, in essence, to stop violence. The healthcare professionals are often turned to. Is that the right system to be relying on?
Well, they're the ones that volunteer the most, because they're the ones that see it the most.
Good point. They usually end up on the healthcare system's doorsteps.
They do, and they're the ones involved in Habitat. They're the ones involved in low-cost housing, getting loans to people.
So you say that then you would agree that there is a role for the healthcare system to be, or they already are maybe de facto.
I mean, that doesn't excuse the rest of the population.
Right. Okay. Does everyone else agree that it is the healthcare system's responsibility, at least to some point, to take care of these societal ills?
I would agree that in a situation where you don't know how to solve a problem, you ask the experts, you as advisors. I think they'd be excellent as advisors. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's going to be a mixture of many different people. There's going to be a financial basis, there's going to be economic mm-hmm. advisors and everything. But in terms of what's really going on, I definitely think that they should serve as advisors because they are involved and immersed in the problems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's sort of like to the degree that they are able to help certain things. I mean, the healthcare field shouldn't necessarily drop all of their research on whatever because they want to change society. But if there are places that, you know, they can do things differently to change that, that's great. And they shouldn't feel above or beyond doing that. And yet, I suppose in a large part, what they need to focus on mostly is responding to the result of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet I would hope that anybody or any industry, given the opportunity to change or improve people's situation, they would take some part in that.
I like that idea of monitoring, but what would it be a yearly monitoring and therefore reassessment and reevaluation, or would it be a 5-year, or, you know, I don't know. But that's just...
Right. Well, those are all extremely important questions that nobody's really come up with the answer yet. And everything's being done, as you guys recommend, on a very patchwork, limited individual, you know, there's a group over here that's monitoring something, there's a group over here that's monitoring something, right? But there's not a coordinated effort to do that. Yeah.
I think if we're gonna try and answer a question, we need to define what is the healthcare system. If you're talking about Department of Health and Human Services on the national level, that might be a little different. If you're talking about the insurance companies, they're not responsible for, you know, housing people necessarily in a direct way. So it's like, what is the healthcare system?
Right. Yeah.
Along with the health's remark, if you're talking about the government part of the healthcare system, then too, isn't that like the government's also involved in housing? The government's also involved in housing and other aspects of it. That's kind of like running a house or even like running Holden. Some people do dish team, some people do garbology. The dish team, Pete, or the kitchen says, well, we've got garbage, but then you say, well, that's your problem. I mean, you kind of, you know, put it all out in different segments mm-hmm. of the population.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me read to you. Last week, again, I don't think any of you were there, so it won't be redundant, but last week, my father mentioned the World Health Organization, which is sort of the public health watchdog across the nation, I mean across the world. They came out with Healthy People 2000, which was an initiative to try to get all of these things elevated for everybody. And they have an interesting definition of health. And when you hear this definition, you realize part of the feasibility of making people better or more well is the responsibility of the healthcare system, if you believe their definition. And basically, WHO defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not just the absence of disease, okay? So then if you buy into the fact that creating health among all populations is the healthcare system's responsibility, you realize that you can't just stop disease, but we're really looking to increase the well-being on all aspects for our population. So therefore, it does then sort of lead the healthcare system at least to be the monitors or the coordinators or the advisors, and maybe just pick up the lead and help bring other people in.
So how are you defining healthcare system?
I'm really going at absolutely the most broad, from everyone from the healthcare providers to the public health planners to our government, because they're funding 50% of our healthcare at this point anyway. I mean, it's...
Well, don't you think then the new concept of preventive medicine versus like curing something after it's happened?
Mm-hmm.
is, I mean, that's your forefront now. That
absolutely. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are very encouraged that we're moving. We're not at all there yet, but that we're actually moving now in the right direction, and that is focusing on the whole person and the well-being rather than just curing the disease, right? So before, again, we get into this, I'll sort of make a little bit of a statement, but that is from a public health perspective, if healthcare is considered, therefore, a right of every citizen, which again is a debatable ethical issue, is healthcare a right, or is it a luxury, or is it, you know, how our society defines this? If healthcare is considered a right of every citizen, and if expanding access to care and achieving equity among the population are our primary goals, then the healthcare system has at least a partial responsibility in ensuring that vulnerable populations are no more vulnerable than the general population. Okay, so it's sort of the healthcare system's goal or striving to at least create some equity among their access and use. To answer your question a little bit, who are these people? I just had written myself a note here that said that this would need a commitment by both the healthcare providers, but by every other organization as well, both in the government and community, to come together, because it just can't be a healthcare system alone. Okay. Well, good. That's a pretty good discussion about what makes people vulnerable, or why we have vulnerable populations, and how to sort of identify them. Let's just talk about a few examples, all right? The homeless. Indicative to the homeless, obviously, is various things like the lack of housing. But let me give you a little bit more of a picture than that. It's just not the full scope of their problem. Currently, there are about 3 million homeless individuals living in the United States. This number, however, increases to 6 million when you count those who have been homeless within the last 5 years. So you see there's a lot of people who are moving from a homeless state to a not homeless state depending on their income levels. And that number goes up to 14 million when you include all of those who have been homeless at some point in their lifetime. That's a pretty big number that people can claim they've been homeless at least some point in their life. The homeless as a subpopulation in the United States are defined in part by their race, ethnicity, and other personal characteristics. So in essence, social status has a lot to do with whether you are homeless or not in our country. 70% of our homeless populations are minorities, and 65% of them are 65 years old or younger. So young people are rather homeless, should be sort of the working population, but many of these people are homeless. And over a third of all the homeless are war veterans in our country. When we talk about the homeless, more than them not having shelter, we talk about them also from their health problem perspective. When you look at it from, again, a healthcare perspective, their health problems differ markedly from the non-homeless. They basically have more illnesses and injuries than the general population. The conditions of being homeless is sort of like a disease-causing agent. You don't really think about it this way, but if you're homeless, you sort of have the absence of protective functions of a home. For instance, rape is 15 times more frequent for homeless women than it is for the general population. The conditions of living outside create this whole disease category for the homeless. It's called thermoregulatory problems. For instance, they have heat stroke, heat exhaustion, hypothermia, and frostbite. Things that we sort of take for granted aren't a problem, but they have this whole scope of disease problems. They also have dehydration, poor nutrition, untreated conditions that they should be taking medications for or be monitoring, they're not. And the effects of alcohol and inadequate clothing, all of this create diseases in them or are agents for creating healthcare problems. And interestingly, the homeless have a whole different set of barriers than other people. I don't know how much you've ever witnessed or read about the homeless population, but often to get food, meals, or to get housing for a night, to be into a shelter, you have to line up. You have to be at certain places at certain times. So both transportation to and from places to get care or to go to soup kitchens or to do these things is impossible. And even if they do, they often won't go to these places because it means it forfeits their ability to get a place to sleep for the night. So when people have gone around and talked to the homeless, they said, well, what, you've got this great place to use for food and health care. Why aren't you using it? It's because they're all lined up at the shelter. Nobody will go there. The hours are wrong and there's no transportation. So they have these various other conflicting barriers that basically don't, they sort of set them up for failure, even if we provide the services around. The other problem is, and unfortunately as well, that homeless are often have a lot of cultural barriers, but also the providers don't want to treat the homeless. They either feel they don't understand their plight, there's a lot of prejudice and bias towards the homeless, and they just basically don't want the homeless in their offices and in their communities lining up outside their doctor's office. So even when the appropriate things have been set up, they often can't even find providers who will treat the homeless population. That's all I'm going to say specifically about the homeless right now, but yeah, let's open it up and talk about it.
I just had a question about war veterans. The percentage is so high. Is that because of their inability to work and their disabilities, or how does that relate to social status, or what? I just thought that was a really high number.
It is a really high number, and a lot of war veterans are, interestingly, have pretty good benefits because of the Veterans Administration system and, yeah, the VA healthcare system. Our veterans have multiple problems usually, from everything from true physical disabilities from wars to mental illness. Their rate of substance abuse is much higher, and all of those things combined sort of put them on this path to either not being able to hold a job, which then creates another path of being homeless, not being able to hold a job for all of the reasons above. There are a lot of programs that the VA provides for veterans, but they're very underused, except for when the veterans get older. The nursing home services are very well used, and the domiciliaries and all these kind of places where veterans can go. It has helped to a certain degree, but the problem with the VA system is that they're not very conveniently located. You know, they're not often in the inner city or can't handle the large population. They're often in the rural areas or spread out. And one of the biggest problems with homeless is they don't have the means of transportation or accessing these places. There have become, in recent years, to sort of legitimize the VA system of healthcare, these big efforts to create van systems and bus systems and give travel vouchers to get to the people. But like I said before, if they're used to where they're living, why would they want to travel out 30 miles away from any sort of network or any sort of world they know to just go to get their blood pressure checked and a few preventive services? I mean, it's a very unfortunate thing that our VA population, our veterans, are making up a third of the homeless, and yet nobody's been able to really get that solved yet. They actually have better services than most everyone. Yeah.
Is the problem of mental health, I can't remember if in your list of what, when you were saying what many of their problems are, how significant is that among homeless? It seems from what I've heard and seen that it must be pretty significant.
I can tell you.
Overall health.
I'll tell you, actually. I was going to talk specifically about mental health and substance abuse, but every time I tried to create a population, it's very elusive. You can't really do that. And I don't know if anyone works specifically in that field here, that's here today, but I found that when you talk about the homeless, you have facts about mental health. When you talk about migrant farm workers, you have facts about substance abuse. But you don't often have a lot of information about the general population because it's very, very difficult to determine. But I have excellent information about the homeless population. One-third of the adults suffer from current major mental illnesses, so schizophrenia, major clinical depression, affective disorders. So one-third of them that are on the streets. And again, you try to think of the cause and effect. Do they have these things because they live on the streets and life is so hard and their nutrition is so bad and they're sick? Or did they go on the streets first because of their mental illness? It's a very difficult relationship to determine. One-third of those who live on the streets have a substance abuse problem. And that means chronic. I mean, they're serious substance abusers, not just users of substances, alcohol or drugs, but have chronic problems. 12% of the people on the streets have both. So they're mentally ill, serious mental illness, and substance abuse problems. Unfortunately, again, a tremendous amount of children live on the streets, and with their families, the homeless families. 47% of all the children under five are developmentally delayed, both mentally and physically. So these kids, when we talked last night, if any of you were at the women, children, and families discussion that we had, these kids are on this path now. If they're under five and they're already this developmentally delayed because of nutrition and all of these, not having a roof over their head, you can imagine what's going to happen to them in 15 years when they're adults. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. And even more sad is 31% of all the kids five and over have clinical major depression. So these poor six-year-olds have been diagnosed with full-blown clinical depression, about a third of them have. So again, you realize it is a huge public health and mental health problem, but at the same time, how do you get them off the streets and get them housed? You know, the insurance company's not gonna start building housing. So there's an answer to your question.
Yeah, and with the numbers being that huge, I mean, you can offer help, and yet if people are really mentally disturbed, that's another barrier to getting to the right bus at the right time and even realizing that you should.
Can you imagine trying to figure all that out just because someone says, well, we need to check you out, right?
I can't find the right bus at the right
time. Well, and also maybe some of them, because of their mental illness or because of the pattern of life, another pattern of life might frighten them, and they really don't want to leave the home. It sounds ridiculous to us to think you don't want to leave the street, but maybe this is the life that they know, and you know, they might not even want help or think they want help.
You know, it's an interesting example of this, which we could talk forever about, but a very interesting example of that are Vietnam veterans. They don't want to have anything to do with something that's government-sponsored. Mm-hmm. I mean, the VA has amazing programs that the private healthcare market doesn't. They have Agent Orange disease program. They have a post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD program. They have very specific veteran need programs. But to get them there is the biggest challenge. Absolutely, absolutely.
Just because they're disillusioned with the government from...
For instance, I was just in Waco, Texas at a VA system, a VA hospital. And Waco, Texas is really small. And it's a 350-bed inpatient psychiatric hospital. Those people who are there have been removed from any sort of social capital, friends, family, anything. If they are in Waco, Texas getting psych care, they are alone, period. There's nobody out there. So you realize we're asking them, we say, hey, we've got Cadillac services for you, but you have to leave anything you might know and go there. But not to attack the veteran system. Like I said, I mean, I'm giving them compliments as well. They do things for veterans that the private market doesn't know how or want to have anything to do with. But how can we coordinate that care to get these vulnerable people to use it appropriately? Well, let's talk a little bit about migrant farm workers and their situation. It's sort of relevant to this area, if any of you are from this area, because the apple farming area has a lot of farm workers. I can't tell you specifically how migrant they are anymore. I hear that many of them have moved into the area and they've established themselves, so they're not sort of the classic moving people who work in the fields. But each year, 3 to 5 million people, both families and individuals, so they're not just single individuals moving around, leave any sort of particular permanent housing they have and follow the crops around the country. Excuse me. These workers are often stigmatized or criticized as being either not really citizens, or worse yet, they're not taxpayers, so why should we support them? Well, there's an interesting study that was done that because of the sales tax and the various other taxes that are paid, they actually pay more tax than they ever have used in public benefits because they are basically ineligible for any public benefit. So it's an interesting argument that's used against sometimes this group of people that they're leeching off of public systems when this group alone, which is an argument in California for illegal immigrants, that they pay so much in taxes just through sales tax alone that they shouldn't necessarily be considered not eligible to use some of our tax-paying system programs. So there's a stigmatization about that. There's also a stigmatization because almost by far this is a racial and ethnic minority. In this part of the world, we basically have Mexican or Latinos. In the Southeast, there's Latinos, there's Haitians, Jamaicans, but almost always it's an ethnic minority. So right there, there's an immediate classification of these people. I'm going through multiple papers here. The other thing that's interesting about this group is they're very apolitical. They don't really vote. Much of their plight goes very unnoticed by the general society. The tragedy about the vulnerability of this population is that it's largely preventable and something that we have all taken very much for granted because we have moved on in our public health. And what I mean by that is that what we consider sort of normal protections, things like sanitation, clean water, adequate toilet facilities, these people have no access to these things. At best, in Texas, they have run, this is considered an improvement, they run an open pipe in sort of a long U shape or half of a square with just water holes so that water gets pumped out and people go in the old-fashioned way, collect water and bring them back to their places. So just even to get fresh water is something, again, that we take for granted that everybody else or the migrant farm workers can't count on. Society has basically laid down rules for employers saying you must have so many toilets per worker and you must have this, but it's so unenforced that at almost any given time, most employers in farm worker areas don't have the adequate or not following the basic policies and regulations. So there's a fair amount of non-compliance by the employers. And I wish very much that someone were a migrant farm employer here, because it'd be interesting to hear what they are subjected to and what their opinion is. Undoubtedly, I'm painting one side of it to them, but it'd be interesting to have someone here to talk about it. Let me give you a little bit of the health side of the migrant farm workers. The agricultural industry, first and foremost, in any way, outside of the farm workers, the migrant ones, they have an occupational mortality of 24 per 100,000, compared to the average for all industries in our country is 5 per 100,000. So even if you work in the farming industry, your chance of death or accident is higher than the general population to begin with. Children, however, of migrant farm workers are exposed to this, which again, we don't even consider because they're exempt. Our country has a loophole. And if you're a farm worker, they're exempt from child labor laws. So where most people can go to work at 16 or above or on a conditional thing at 14 or 15, children of migrant farm workers are working in the fields long, long, long before that. And therefore, they're adding to the economic wealth of their family just in small bits, but they're also subjected to a much higher exposure to pesticides, exposure to all these unclean situations, and also just the accident rate being much higher. So talking a little bit about their particular plight, first of all, they have, like I mentioned, very little political power influence. So this is a group that is so vulnerable that they sort of need intervention from the outside. They probably can't do anything themselves. Our reaction to talking about the veterans who are homeless is sort of this gut isn't that bad, and the veterans have a pretty large, pretty substantial political influence in our country. That's why we have the great services they do. Very few people are going to come forward and vote on things or create a system for the farm workers. Secondly, the level of education is zilch. I mean, there is no educational anything provided to these people. There's no schools, there's no teachers, there's nothing. And because there are so many families out there working, we're creating another generation that are completely uneducated. So we're not doing anything to stop the process or stop the trend.
In a small scale, that's not true. State of Michigan has the way of schooling for migrant workers, and we have summer school for the children of migrant workers.
Are those people somewhat established in a community, or do they move? So it could be different attendees every few months.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't winter there.
Or just for the summer.
They're just summer. Well, they come as soon as a crop start coming, like asparagus in the spring.
How do the children go to school there if they're needing to work in the fields?
They don't work in the fields, the little ones. I mean, I don't know how old, but this would be preschool. It may go up to maybe 8 or something. I don't know how old.
Right.
You know, but the little ones are being cared for.
At least. I mean, that's good news. Unfortunately, no one's getting past a third grade education again. Mm-hmm. But at least they're doing something to get the little ones, even the littlest ones, out of the field.
Well, the older ones, though, let's see, I don't know. I know they're in the school system. Now, I don't, because they come and go. So I don't know if they have to go to school or not, but you do have the migrant workers in the school system when they're in town, when they're in the community.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that might contribute to people potentially sticking around and not leaving if they have the access.
It's possible that they do eventually put roots down. I don't.
Does anyone know about Wenatchee's situation or the apple orchards? Because I've really heard when I was talking
they're
to some people.
They're staying longer. Mm-hmm. And settling in, mm-hmm. and establishing a home base in Wenatchee or some of the other.
And then potentially moving out as the crops go, but coming back to Wenatchee, mm-hmm. huh?
That's quite conflictual with the old timers in some of these smaller communities, mm-hmm. having mm-hmm. Spanish people.
Yeah, that's true.
Just
anyway.
Leaving things around, you know, and crud and whatnot. Not maybe being able to converse and whatever, you know.
Right. Bit. And then when we talk about the educational system, the healthcare system, and social support services going to, I mean, I heard that the Wenatchee population is about 40% at this point. Farm workers are Latino, basically.
Some of the smaller communities are much higher than that.
Much higher than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, some of the schools here, we get school children from Chelan and Manson each year, and there's a high proportion mm-hmm. of Latino mm-hmm. children. So how many of them are migrants that have settled or whatever? But there are certainly the children in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confused as to their political status. Are they illegal immigrants, or are they, what is their, if they're illegal immigrants, then they're deported, or they're left? What, I don't understand their status.
I don't know about Washington. I would imagine there's a mix. In California, there's obviously a mix. There's a tremendous amount of illegal, undocumented immigrants.
So
just
legal,
a tremendous amount. But you understand the employers will not turn them in.
The legal ones are not required to go to school.
There are different there's different status. You can be a legal immigrant versus a citizen. And when it comes to the child welfare law or the child labor laws, it's not the person's status, it's that the agricultural industry is exempt from child labor law. So it doesn't. If you or I were working out in the fields, we could have a kid 8 years old out there. It makes no difference. It's the agricultural industry that's been exempt that, again, it's like a loophole. So
are you sure of that?
Mm-hmm.
All,
that the school system wouldn't go out there and nail those people? Ooh, I question that.
Yeah. They're also exempt from collective bargaining,
yeah.
Which is why it's been one of the reasons it's so hard to unionize.
Yeah, because there have been, you see, well, this is getting run off the path, but you see no grapes. Do you guys see that up here? You see no grapes on the back of a lot of farm workers' trucks and agricultural people, workers. And it was a movement to have like a union, and in the simplest of explanations, to have a union. And there are absolutely no laws encouraging it or allowing it. And so they lose. It's an amazing sort of old-fashioned class system.
You know? That's one of the reasons they become vulnerable, because they don't have the same kind of labor power that
and protection.
The auto workers do, for example. And
right.
So they can't go to the table in the same way and say, we'd like health insurance as part of our compensation package.
School laws.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to be exempt from working, but there's also the school truancy laws that, you know, you need to go to school in this country.
But they're really hard to I mean, those truancy laws are hard enough in cities where you've got kids in homes and kids aren't going to school, but where you've got people who either have, you know, I mean, who knows where they live if they're migrant.
Well, and the parents don't want them in school.
It's right, because they're losing a third, a fourth, a fifth of their income if they're child.
Right.
That's why I said it's interesting.
It's really hard to...
But I do think that there are truancy laws. In other words, they're doing it illegally.
Right.
Illegally from the school's point of view, but not illegally from the work point of view.
And you realize that it's a complete contradiction in laws. The agricultural industry is exempt from child labor laws, saying children can work in the field. But if they're, I don't know, I'm the first to claim I don't know exactly what the truancy law says, but if it's true that an overarching truancy law says kids have to be in school, they conflict. The other thing is, these people, the people who own apple orchards and avocado farms or whatever, their livelihood is based on these people out in the fields. So no one's going to turn the other people in and say, I think you have 100 children working in your field. You know, who's going to turn the other person in? You may get, on a limited basis, a fact-finding mission to go out by some bureau of whatever, to go out, you know, the Child Health Bureau or something, and nail these people for not having them in school or something, but it's just as a overall effort, it is completely, talking about the political issue, it's completely, the heads are turned, and that's the way our crops get picked.
Well, and probably the school,
it's not cost effective.
Well, the school probably turns their head too, because what chaos that would be in the school if for 1 month of the year they had 300 more kids.
How many schools are dying to have more migrant worker children
that
in the school?
Well, just the medical leaves, they get state aid. They'd love to have, you get
really?
First Friday in September, first Friday count, you get your state aid. Yeah, I'd be very happy.
But, you know, if you just have them coming in on October for, you know, 3 weeks or 2 weeks, you know, it's not going to...
And undoubtedly, I'm sure a lot of that gaming goes on.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they count up the numbers, they get the aid, and, oh, we haven't seen, you know, Ernesto. We haven't seen him now for 6 months. Oops. It's a good thing we got the state aid starting October. I mean, it's... Anyway, you're all beginning to get a good picture as to, one, the health problems of these people, but two, how it has so little to do with the healthcare system in some ways. We often turn to the healthcare system, but what about all of these other groups? Okay.
And maybe this is where this is headed next, but so where are these people getting their healthcare when they need it? I mean,
emergency rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Expensive.
Especially this group. Migrant farm workers are going to emergency rooms.
Yeah.
At best, there are charitable volunteer providers who will go out, do preventive care, do some immunizations, but it's all piecemeal. I'm not saying that there aren't things being provided, but it's completely piecemeal. There are no collective efforts like there are for the homeless, like there are for the vets, like there are for these. The programs are very, very, whatever charity that community feels like providing.
The one good piece of news I got from some of the healthcare providers in Chelan is that the women get excellent prenatal care because they love their children. I mean, that's part of the...
Mm-hmm.
The
is that right?
Oh, yeah.
The two things is, you know, kids are all important.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get good prenatal care. They take care of themselves.
Who do they pay for that out of their own pocket?
I don't know. Well, I know there's some clinics and stuff that they can go to. I don't know what. Do you know anything about the local stuff, Mark?
I don't know. Nothing's coming to mind on that. Mm-hmm.
All I know is that they are coming in and they're getting good care, and they tend to have actually very successful birth and low mortality.
The thing that's interesting, if you can put the racial bias and prejudice aside, which LA, as you all know, has a heck of a lot of problems. But one of the things that it's interesting to live there is that there's probably not a more diverse city in the world. And it's an interesting experiment every day, because this migrant farm working population, if you think about it, works hard, has good family values, has a lot of potential. They just don't have any
clout.
Access and these other things that, if they were provided, they could be very substantial. I mean, you can't point a finger and say you just don't contribute, or you just don't work hard enough. So I find that a very compelling population to what if we gave services. They're not down the line sick like the mentally ill or the homeless population that are often further in their lives and have serious problems to reverse. Instead, we have a sort of burgeoning population that is basically set to be productive. So if we can maintain their options to remain productive, we don't have to necessarily set these kids off in being uneducated or poor health, and yet that's what we're doing right now. So let me get to the third distinctive population. I've learned some about them in this past year. And that is Native Americans. I'm going to call them Indians because our government is called the health service that's provided them, the Indian Health Service, or IHS. I actually do prefer Native Americans, but that's why I'm calling it the Indian Health Services, because that's the formal name. Just so you know, it's based on the U.S. government's trust responsibility from treaties. I can't tell you exactly what that means, but there is this thing called the trust responsibility in the treaties that were signed for the Native Americans. The Indian Health Service was established. It was sort of the obligation of, we will provide basic minimum health services to these reservations. However, although the treaties provided that, there are there's 547 federally recognized tribes, which equals about 134 million American Indians in our country. Having said that, the Indian Health Services currently has 35 hospitals and about 250 contracted providers. So if you just think of that right there, you realize how underserved this population is.
Yeah, but they're serving themselves. Well, they're doing a fantastic job.
Yeah, we'll get to that a little bit. That's why it's an interesting group. When we speak specifically about the Indians' vulnerability, their health status has improved basically since 1955 under the IHS, but it's still not comparable to that of other Americans when compared against the general population. Their risks are pretty frightening. Their alcoholism mortality rate, so their death rate from alcohol, is 440% higher than the general population. Their accident rates are 165% higher than ours, and their murder rate is 50% higher than the general population, and their suicide rate is 43% higher than the general population.
The accident rate, what's that from?
Mainly cars. Mainly cars, but other home accidents and things like that as well. But there's a lot of anecdotal stories about the driving habits of the reservation.
And then also that's connected to the alcoholism?
Yes, absolutely. There was a woman physician who works for the IHS who came, and I talked to her for quite a while, and she told the story, not to go off too far, but she told the story of, it's a very popular social thing to all drive in a reservation, people that live all over the place, to drive to a common crossing road and to drink beer, and 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 then everyone drives home. And she said the accident rates from that alone are inordinate. I mean, it's just amazing. And it's something that, that's sort of a part of the culture and the social behavior.
Sort of like suburban American teenagers.
Going out to field parties.
We did the same thing.